From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, December 19th, 2017. And on this day, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree says she won't run for governor. And some big Maine companies were massively underbilled for their power. Now it's up to regulators to decide whether they have to pay that money back. Those stories in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org.
As we've been reporting, Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree announced today that she is not planning to run for governor. Her decision ends widespread speculation about her intentions and leaves intact a crowded field of 22 declared candidates, including 10 Democrats. Steve Missler has details.
Pingree says her decision to stay out of what's expected to be a wild governor's race is because the progressive struggle is acutely focused on Congress and the White House.
The dangers that we are facing right now as a nation and a state, the challenges that we have in front of us with this crazy administration, and real work that needs to be done that hasn't been done by this Congress. I want to continue the fight, whether it's on global warming or the cost of health care, trying to restore the middle class and fight back against this tax cut, which is going to decimate our middle class. There is so much work to be done.
Pingree's reasoning, posted in a video message, was similar to that of Republican U.S. Senator Susan Collins. In the fall, Collins also spurned the temptation to replace Republican Governor Paul LePage, whose second term ends next year. But unlike Collins, who openly flirted with a gubernatorial bid for the better part of a year, Pingree made her decision after publicly floating her possible candidacy just 2 weeks ago.
And while it would be wonderful to run across the state, to run for governor of the state of Maine, we really need someone who can undo the damage that this governor has done to our state. There are some great Democratic candidates out there, and I have no doubt that one of them will make a wonderful governor.
The quick turnaround of Pingree's announcement was a sharp contrast to Collins, who drew out the suspense for months before announcing her decision at a business event in Rockport that garnered national media coverage. Both women were arguably their party's top prospects to replace LePage next year, but both may have had other reasons to stay out of the governor's race. Collins was considered a favorite to win the contest, but only if she could woo GOP primary voters, sometimes hostile to her image as a moderate. It was the opposite for Pingree. Her consistent positions on progressive policy issues would have made her the favorite in the Democratic primary, but Pingree's reputation as a liberal champion may have also given her trouble in the general election, and especially in parts of the state that last year voted for President Trump and LePage twice before that. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
We're all familiar with getting overbilled for something and asking for our money back. But what happens if you get underbilled? That's the issue in a case pending before the Maine Public Utilities Commission. Documents show that over an extended period of time, a Maine natural gas company undercharged a group of its biggest commercial customers by almost $500,000. And as Fred Bever reports, regulators now have to decide whether those companies should be required to pay that back.
Maine Natural Gas is a mid-coast supplier owned by Avangrid, which also owns Central Maine Power. Earlier this year, it discovered that it had been misreading the meters of a dozen of its largest customers for varying amounts of time, for as little as a year to as many as 13 years. Company officials declined to be interviewed, but in filings with the Public Utilities Commission, they pegged the total value of what they undercharged at $456,000. The company rebilled those customers for the last 12 months, as it says the law allows it to do. But one of the customers, the authority that runs Brunswick Landing, was handed a new six-figure bill.
Well, I think it's in excess of $100,000.
Steve Levesque is executive director of the Mid-Coast Regional Redevelopment Authority, which oversees Brunswick Landing, site of the former Brunswick Naval Air Station. He says it appears that Maine Natural Gas misread the meter at one particular hangar, which housed several enterprises.
Obviously, it's an impact in coming up with that money, trying to go back to tenants, because what we do is we get a bill, and then we bill the tenants based upon our bill. So we'd have to go back to tenants, some of which aren't even in existence anymore. Kestrel Aircraft was one of those tenants in part of that building.
Maine Natural Gas says most of the affected customers have already paid their makeup bills, but it's agreed not to take action against those that haven't, such as the Redevelopment Authority, pending the outcome of the Public Utilities Commission's inquiry. The identity of most of those companies is not being disclosed in public documents, and the proceeding is still in its early stages. Barry Hobbins, the state's public advocate, says one key question will be whether Maine Natural Gas should be required to collect underpayments from earlier years, and whether it should give credits to other customers who may have been paying for costs that they shouldn't have.
Which obviously causes a significant problem with the possibility of overbilling those other users.
In its filings, Maine Natural Gas says its shareholders bore the brunt of the underbillings, and they should not be required to provide any credits. The case is not expected to be resolved until next year. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
A state commission tasked with helping military veterans find jobs officially started work this week, and the panel's co-chair has already identified a potential challenge changing the attitudes of state licensing boards. Mal Leary has more.
The commission is charged with recommending ways to help veterans transition from a military job to a civilian one. But the panel's co-chair, Lewiston Democrat Jared Golden, says it faces a big hurdle. And that's the position of many state licensing boards that are willing to substitute education for experience, but not experience for education. For example, he says some states allow a former Army medic or Navy corpsman with years of experience to take a licensing test even if they don't have a college degree. But Maine is not one of them. And Golden says that may be something that has to change if the state is serious about employing them. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Finally today, picture the classic Victorian Christmas. A stately evergreen in the grandest room of the family home, thick boughs reaching up to almost touch the ceiling. It's a pretty vision, but these days more people are downsizing and they may even opt for a tiny tree in a pot that can be replanted. As Jennifer Mitchell reports, it's a market forces thing.
This little green one here seems to need a home.
I don't know, Charlie Brown. Remember what Lucy said? This doesn't seem to fit the modern spirit.
Remember this scene from A Charlie Brown Christmas, when Charlie Brown goes shopping for a tree for the neighborhood Christmas play? He passes by a lot filled with big, flashy trees and chooses instead a scrawny sapling, which draws withering scorn from his friends.
What a tree!
I guess you were right, Linus. I shouldn't have picked this little tree.
Or perhaps Charlie Brown was just ahead of his time.
Our business is leaning towards shorter trees than it used to. We used to sell a lot of 8, 9, 10-foot trees.
That's Dana Graves, who's been growing Christmas trees for more than 40 years with G&S Christmas Tree Farm. Today, he's showing off a row of neat, bushy little balsam firs for sale, none higher than 4 feet, at Sprague's Nursery in Bangor.
That little one on the end, yeah, that's a tabletop tree. Somebody will put in their house in a small apartment on the table, yep.
The farm still produces plenty of taller trees, too. But Graves says it's pretty rare these days to get orders for anything higher than 7 feet.
Found a good one, huh, guys?
Yeah.
Awesome. Want it wrapped up?
Several miles away at Carpenter Tree Farm in Old Town, Jeff and Jillian Woodbury are complete newbies in the Christmas tree business. It's just their second season. But they, too, say they're finding some brisk trade in catering to customers who are looking for something other than that giant centerpiece tree.
Like these guys said, they're on the second floor of an apartment house, so they got to climb 2 sets of stairs.
We get a lot of college kids or small apartments, so they're looking for something smaller, more manageable to get in and out of their apartment, maybe up some stairs. There was one couple with 6 flights of stairs, I believe. So that was a long haul with a big tree. They were looking for something more 4 foot or smaller.
Makes it much easier for them.
It's all part of a trend, says Marcia Gray with the National Christmas Tree Association. Older Americans, she says, and those with no kids at home have always been more likely to demand a small tree, but they didn't have many options.
In the past, small trees, what we call a tabletop, now sometimes it was the top of a bad tree, or it was, you know, a tree that got a ding at the bottom or something. Now we have growers specifically culturing trees to be a tabletop.
That entails special trimming so the mini tree bushes out into a nice full shape. Another factor that helped develop a little tree market was an interior decorating trend that started about 10 years ago, as homeowners started putting up multiple trees in dining rooms, living rooms, porches, and windows instead of just the one big central tree.
We saw a lot of parents buying small trees for their children's bedrooms. They each got their own little tree.
All of this contributed to the emergence of a burgeoning little tree industry, which is just now coming into full flower. A healthy market for little trees could also be good news for a farmer's bottom line, as they take less time to grow. It takes a full decade to grow a 6-foot tree, while small trees can be turned over in about half the time. And that, in turn, has another benefit, says Gray. Keeping large tracts of land in constant production helps offset greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, something she says is important to many consumers who seek a natural Christmas tree.
Younger trees are much more efficient at taking in the carbon dioxide and outputting the oxygen. The older a tree gets, the slower that process. So by keeping these young trees planted, harvested, replanted, that whole cycle, we're really ensuring some very productive trees as far as oxygen production.
Along the same lines, some growers are offering tiny potted trees that can be set out after the season. But Gray says that effort has met with limited success, simply because not everyone has a green thumb.
I never thought it was such a bad little tree. It's not bad at all, really. Maybe it just needs a little love.
Americans will buy about 40 million trees of all size this year and spend an estimated $2 billion in the process. Gray says there will always be a market for a big, impressive tree that skims the cathedral ceiling, but there's no longer a Charlie Brown stigma to having a little one. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, December 19th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.